Good morning. I'm Linda Field, your moderator for today. I'm pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's speaker, Thomas Cathcart. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's musician, Jose Lascano, for recording the music many of you enjoyed while waiting for the live broadcast to begin. Also, thank you to the Verney Foundation for generously sponsoring today's event. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. We deeply appreciate your donations, which this year has been made may be made on our website or by mailing your donation. During this challenging time, we need your help even more than ever. Today's talk will be recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. The talk will also be rebroadcast on WSMN next Sunday at 11 a.m. and on WUML this coming Wednesday at 10 a.m. As is the tradition of the Lyceum, after the presentation, our speaker will answer your questions from the audience. Please submit your questions by using the comments section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email at monlyceum@gmail.com. That's monlyceum@gmail.com. After the broadcast, you may provide feedback on today's program, suggestions for next summer's speakers, or join our mailing list through our website. Our speaker today is Thomas Cathcart. Unfortunately, his writing partner and good friend, Daniel Klein, cannot join us due to a family illness. However, we're thrilled to have Tom here today. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein met over 60 years ago when they were both philosophy majors at Harvard University. Contrary to popular opinion, philosophy majors can make a living. Daniel, after a brief career writing television comedy, went on to become a prolific author of novels, thrillers, mysteries, and nonfiction works. Tom, after getting his degree in philosophy, studied theology at the University of Chicago and embarked on an eclectic career path from college teaching to hospice management. At the age of 67, he collaborated with his longtime friend Danny in writing Plato and the Platypus Walk into a Bar, which is a tour of philosophical concepts explained through the use of jokes. In the preface, the authors make the following connection. Philosophy and jokes tease the mind in similar ways. That's because they proceed from the same impulse to confound our sense of the way things are, to flip our worlds upside down, and to ferret out hidden, often uncomfortable truths about life. What a philosopher calls an insight, the gagster calls a zinger. The book became an international bestseller and launched a series of books, among them Heidegger and a Hippo Walk into a Bar, Aristotle and an Aardvark Go to Washington, and their most recent collaboration, I Think, Therefore I Draw. Tom also wrote The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge, a philosophical conundrum. As you struggle with this last question, it's with great joy and anticipation that I ask you to join me in welcoming Thomas Cathcart.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. And thank you, Monadnock Lyceum. It's a real pleasure to be here this morning. And by here, of course, I mean in my dining room, where Linda said a few minutes before we went on that maybe this year it's not so bad that this has to be on Zoom, because apparently the church is not air conditioned. So hopefully you're in an air conditioned space, and we'll have some fun together today. Danny and I have done a lot of public speaking over the last few years. I must say, though, that this is a first in many ways. One of them is that I think this is the first time we've ever spoken to a group where half of you are still in your pajamas. You know who you are. So, as Linda mentioned, Danny's unable to be here this morning due to an illness in his family. We send him our best wishes, him and his family, our best wishes. And he sends you his warm regards. He's very sorry not to be here. He was looking forward to it. And so you get me. So Linda was telling us that some of our previous speakers have been Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Toni Morrison. So this morning I was sort of picturing them looking down on us from up above and saying, WTF, how did this series get so far off the tracks here? Hopefully they'll get with it as we get into it sooner. Danny and I, as Linda mentioned, have been friends since 1957, 63 years for you math majors. And we met actually on the first day of our freshman year in college. Danny was standing in my room when I walked in. He was talking to my roommates, and we became fast friends. And we've become best friends over many, many decades now. During a lot of that time, all but 1 year, actually, we never lived in the same place. For 1 year, we lived together in Woodstock, not together, but we both lived in Woodstock, New York. But other than that, we've always lived in disparate places. Danny, for a while, lived in Greece. For a while, he lived in the Caribbean. I lived in more mundane places like New England. But over the years, we've kept up that friendship. In the beginning, it was by letter. You remember letters, the pen and the stamp and envelope. And then, more recently by email. So anyway, we've had this wonderful, long, long friendship. So Danny called me up one night in 2006, and he said, I want to tell you a joke. And as Linda mentioned, Danny has been a comedy writer, and he often tells me jokes. So he said, here's a joke I just heard. He said, I think it's pretty good. He said, a man is making love to his best friend's wife. All of a sudden, they hear a car in the driveway, and the woman knows it's the husband's car. So the guy jumps out of bed, runs into the closet, and closes the door. So meanwhile, the husband walks into the room, takes off his jacket, goes to the closet to hang it up, and there's his best friend, Lou, standing there stark naked. And the guy says, Lou, what are you doing here? And Lou says, everybody's got to be somewhere. So I said, Danny, there's a little philosophical angle to that joke. And as Linda said, we both majored in philosophy 100 years ago. And Danny said, yeah, really, what is it? And I said, well, the guy in the closet, Lou, is giving a Hegelian answer to what was intended as an existentialist question. That's probably what you all thought, right? And then he says, oh, yeah, well, I see what you're saying. So, Lou is kind of looking down on the situation from up in the sky somewhere and giving this sweeping, supposedly objective view of the world. And he says, everybody's got to be somewhere. But of course, that's not the husband's question. The husband is saying, wait a minute, what are you as an individual, Lou, doing in my closet, stark naked, of all things? So Danny goes, oh, yeah, there's a book in that. I was skeptical. Danny, at that point, had been writing books for 30 years. And he often says, there's a book in this. And often he's right. And sometimes he's not right. So I said, Danny, I don't think so. There are probably four jokes in the world that do that. And Danny said, no. He said, there are hundreds of them. I said, okay, let's test it out. So we went to Gloucester, Massachusetts, and we checked into a motel, and we spent the weekend with a pile of philosophy books on one side, a pile of joke books on the other side. And at the end of the weekend, I said, You're right. There are hundreds of jokes that illustrate philosophical points. So we wrote the book. We called it Plato and a Platypus, Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. And 40 publishers turned it down. I didn't even know there were 40 publishers, but it was turned down by 40 publishers. But our agent, Julia Lord, bless her heart, kept sending it out. And number 41, Harry Abrams, said, yeah, let's take a look at this. So Harry Abrams, the Lyceum crowd probably knows, is a publisher of these big coffee table art books, you know, beautifully bound, beautifully reproduced. And that was what they published. Harry Abrams. Well, it turned out that they were starting a new imprint. They were calling it Abrams Image. And they decided that they wanted something a little off the beaten track. And so this book was definitely off the beaten track, as 40 publishers will attest. So anyway, we sold them the book. And then we just got really, really lucky. Unbelievably lucky. It was kind of chugging along. I had sold 2,200, you know, on Amazon, where you can look at the ranking, 2,234 in the rankings or something like that. And Abrams was tickled pink. They thought that was great. Apparently, Art of the Northern Renaissance doesn't sell that well. But in any case, they were pleased. And then, as I said, we got lucky. Our publicist had sent the book to Leanne Hansen. Leanne Hansen, you'll remember, used to be the host of a Weekend Edition Sunday on NPR, which is on right now, actually. So it tickled her funny bone, apparently. And so she reached out to us and said, we'd like to have you on the show. Well, as you know, the show has 1.5 hour. It's a little on the goofy side. They have Will Shorts on giving goofy puzzles, and then they always have a goofy story. We were the goofy story. So she interviewed us, and we recorded it on a Friday, and it played on Sunday, of course. So about an hour before it went on, I looked on Amazon to see how we were doing, 2,237 or something like that. I thought, well, an hour after it's over, I'll check again and see what's happening. So I did. I went, oh, my God. So I called Danny and I said, have you looked at Amazon? He said, no. I said, we're number 3. So NPR listeners read books. Who knew? But in any case, from there, it just got better and better because of that fast start. It eventually ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. Abrams ran out of books, so it dropped off the list for a few weeks while they reprinted, and then it jumped back on the list again. A year later, Penguin bought the paperback rights, and it went on the bestseller list for a while. Other countries, I think 28 different languages, bought the book. And in some of those countries, it became a bestseller as well. I mean, it was like crazy. It was really nuts. So we've had a lot of fun with this over the years. And so we're really happy to be here once again, talking about Plato and a Platypus and how jokes can actually illustrate philosophical points. So one of the things we discovered was that every major branch of Western philosophy has jokes that illustrate points. For example, logic. Logic is obviously a key branch of philosophy. And Aristotle was the first of the major logicians. He wrote a book called Logic. In that book, he sort of set out what he thought were the sort of the basic rules of logic, particularly deductive logic. And so one of his, in fact, his first principle was what he called the law of non-contradiction. and the law of non-contradiction. So it's a fancy word for the obvious fact that the obvious fact, which now has escaped my brain, is the obvious fact that a statement and its contrary can't both be true at the same time, in the same sense. You know, I mean, obviously that has to be the first principle, because if you didn't accept that, then you couldn't make rational sense out of anything. You know, no other rule of logic would mean anything if you couldn't be consistent from, you know, statement to statement. So here's an example. So a rabbi is holding court in the village, and Shmuel stands up and he says, "Rabbi," he says, "I have a complaint." He says, "Itzhak here runs his sheep over my land every day." And he says, "I'm getting sick and tired of it, and I want you to tell him that that's not right and that he should stop." The rabbi says, "You're right." But then Itzhak stands up and he says, "Well, wait a minute, Rabbi." He says, "Going over Shmuel's land is the only way my sheep can get to the watering hole. And there's been a long tradition, centuries long, that there's a right of way to the pond because everybody needs to get their livestock to the water. So I should be able to do this." And the rabbi says, "You're right." And the old guy in the back says, well, wait, hold on, Rabbi. They can't both be right." And the rabbi says, "You're right." The law of non-contradiction. So the guy in the back has just told the rabbi that he has violated the law of non-contradiction, which I guess for a rabbi isn't as bad as violating the law against coveting your neighbor's maidservant, but, you know, it's right up there. So here's a joke that actually shows what happens if you don't follow the law of non-contradiction. So an Irishman goes into a Dublin pub. He sits down at the bar and he says, "Bartender, I'll have 3 pints of Guinness, if you would." And the bartender says, sure, lad. And he pours him the 3 pints, sits them down. The man drinks a sip from the first, and a sip from the second, a sip from the third. And then he goes back to the first, takes a sip, sip from the second, sip from the third, and he continues to drink them that way until they're gone. And he says, "Bartender, I'll have 3 more pints if you would." And the bartender says, "Well, sure, but could I make a suggestion? They'd be less likely to go flat if you let me pour them one at a time." The guy says, "Oh, I know that." He said, "The reason I do this is because I have 2 brothers. He says, "One of them's in Australia, one of them's in the States." And he said, "We made a pledge to each other that we would always drink like this in honor of the days when we used to drink together." And the bartender says, "Well, that's a lovely, lovely custom." So he pours him 3 more pints. The guy drinks them the same way, sip, 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 pays the bill, and leaves. So the next night he walks in, orders the same way. The bartender pays him, draws his Guinness the same way, drinks them, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, orders 3 more, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and leaves. So he becomes a regular in the bar. He's there every night, has his regular stool. So one night he comes in, he sits down in the stool, and he says, "Bartender, I'll have 2 pints of Guinness, if you would." And a hush falls over the bar. And the bartender says, "Oh, lad, please accept my condolences." They said, no, everybody's fine. He said, "I just became a Mormon and I had to give up drinking." The law of non-contradiction. So Aristotle also set out a complete list of logical fallacies, all the ways that you could screw up an argument. And there was quite a list of them. And it hasn't really been improved on much in the meantime. It's still sort of the basic list of logical fallacies. And one of those is the circular argument. We're all familiar with the circular argument, you know, the argument that circles around on itself. And so here's a story. So an Indian chief is brand new, and he's been educated at Dartmouth. And he doesn't really know the old Indian lore. So he's kind of feeling his way. One day the tribe comes to him and they say, Chief, we need to know, is it going to be a cold winter? The chief has no idea. So he says, well, check back with me tomorrow. I'll take this under advisement. So he calls the National Weather Service and he says, look, he said, you know, my people are asking me what kind of winter is it going to be? He said, what do you think? And the Weather Service guy says, well, we think it's going to be a pretty cold winter. So he gets the tribe back together again. And he says, you know, I'm thinking that it's going to be a very, you know, a pretty cold winter. So the Indians go out and they gather firewood, get ready for the winter. And a couple of weeks later, they come back and they say, well, we're just checking in again. You know, how's it looking now? Do you still think it's going to be a cold winter? He says, well, you know, check back with me tomorrow. So he calls the Weather Service again. He says, well, how's it looking? How's the winter looking? What are you thinking now? The Weather Service guy says, well, we're thinking it's going to be a very cold winter. He says, gets the braves together again and says, well, I'd say it's going to be a very cold winter. So the Indians go out and they gather some more firewood. So a few weeks later, they come back and they say, well, Chief, you know, winter's coming on us here. You know, we need to check with you one more time. What are you thinking now about the winter? So, of course, he calls the National Weather Service again. And the Weather Service guy says, yeah. It's now it's looking like a really cold winter. So gets the braves together again, tells them. They go out and gather more firewood. Finally, on middle of December, they come back and they say, well, you know, Chief, what do you think now? So, of course, he calls the National Weather Service again. He says, you know, what do you think now? Winter's almost here. Is it going to be a cold winter or what? Weather Service guy says, this is going to be one of the coldest winters on record. And she says, oh, okay. Can I ask you, how do you know that? The Weather Service guy says, well, the Indians are gathering wood like crazy. The circular argument. So another of Aristotle's fallacies that he identified was post hoc ergo propter hoc. Your organization has a Latin name, so I know you all know that post hoc ergo propter hoc means after this, therefore because of this. And it's the fallacy that says because event A happened and then soon after event B happened, that A must have been the cause of B. Sometimes that's true, but sometimes it's not true. Well, it turns out there are a lot of post hoc ergo propter hoc jokes. And here's one of my favorites, one of Danny's favorites. I send this one out to you, Danny. The famous towel joke. So an older man, is married to a younger woman. And no matter how hard he tries, he just really cannot satisfy her in bed. So they go to the rabbi. A lot of logic jokes are Jewish for some reason. I have no idea why. Danny has no idea why, but they are. So anyway, they go to the rabbi, and the rabbi says, there's a strategy that we use in this situation. He said, what you need to do is when you go home, get a younger man to stand next to the bed while you make love. And he says, you know, get him to wave a towel. I mean, get him to wave a towel over the bed while you and your wife make love. So the guy says, okay. So they go home and they get in bed. They make an arrangement with a guy next door, young man next door, to come over and stand next to the bed and wave the towel. So she feels nothing, zero, nothing at all. So they get up, they go back to the rabbi and they say, look, you know, that didn't solve the problem. He says, well, sometimes we have to make a little adjustment. He said, this time when you go home, he said, you put the young man in bed with your wife and you wave the towel. The guy says, okay. So they go home. The young man gets in bed with the wife and the older man stands there and waves the towel. She is in seventh heaven. She is having the most wonderful, loving experience. And just at the peak of her pleasure, the old guy looks down and he goes, schmuck, that's the way you wave a towel. Post hoc, ergo propter hoc. As I mentioned, there are a bunch of post hoc, ergo propter hoc jokes. Here's another one. A Gentile man is about to marry a Jewish woman. And a few weeks before the wedding, she calls him up and says, honey, I have kind of a big favor to ask you. She said, it would mean a great deal to my mother if you were to convert to Judaism. So the guy thinks about it. He says, yeah, I could do that, honey. If it means that much to your mother, let's do that. I'll convert to Judaism. So he says, tell me what to do. She said, well, I don't know everything, but she said, one thing I know for sure, you'll have to get circumcised. The guy says, circumcised? Geez, at my age, isn't that painful? She said, well, I really don't know. So he calls up a Jewish male friend. And he says, look, I'm about to convert to Judaism and I have to get circumcised. He said, I'm just wondering, you know, at my age, is that going to hurt? And the friend says, well, to tell you the truth, I was 8 days old when I had it done, so I don't remember whether it hurt or not. But I'll tell you this, I couldn't walk for a year afterwards. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. So Aristotle was one of the pioneers, not only of logic, but of many other branches of philosophy as well, including metaphysics. He also wrote a book called Metaphysics. Metaphysics, as you probably know, is the big questions. You know, does God exist? Is there free will? What is the meaning of life? You know, all the biggies. Philosopher is looking for first principles. You know, he strokes his beard and sits there and tries to discern rationally what the first principles of the universe are, what makes it work. And so one of the things that Aristotle came up with is what he called telos. And telos means inner aim or goal. It's everything has one, he says. The telos of an acorn is oak tree, right? It's the inner aim. It's what the acorn is trying to become. And so he said, everything has a telos. He said, even people have a telos too. So here's the story. Again, a Jewish woman, Mrs. Goldstein, is walking down the street with her grandchildren. And a neighbor is walking by and she says, oh, Mrs. Goldstein, this must be your grandchildren. She says, yes, it is. And she says, oh, they're lovely. She said, how old are they? And Mrs. Goldstein said, well, the doctor is 5 and the lawyer is 7. she can already see their telos. So another of Aristotle's first principles was, he said there are two kinds of characteristics that everything has: essential characteristics and accidental characteristics. Essential characteristics are the characteristics that make a thing what it is. If it didn't have those characteristics, it would be something else. Essential, we would call them the defining characteristics, right? The things that make the characteristics that make a thing what it is. He said everything else is accidental characteristics. You know, the thing may or may not have them. You know, sometimes it may have those characteristics and sometimes it doesn't. You know, they're accidental. So he said, here's an example. He said, Socrates was essentially rational. It was part of his very essence. And consequently, if you ran into somebody on the street that you thought was Socrates, but after talking with him, it turned out that you were talking to somebody who wasn't rational, well, you weren't talking to Socrates because Socrates was essentially rational. But he said, on the other hand, he said, Socrates had a snub nose. And he said, that's totally accidental. So if he didn't have a snub nose, you wouldn't say, well, it's not Socrates. So if he had his nose fixed, you'd say, well, he's Socrates, but he's Socrates with a nose job. So that's the distinction, essential and accidental characteristics. So Thompson, the original version of this story, had a Jewish character too. But we had so many Jewish characters that we changed many of the names. So he's Thompson now. So Thompson is about to turn 70. And so he decides that he's going to try to get really healthy and increase his lifespan. And so he goes into a total fitness program. He jogs. He does calisthenics every morning. He goes on a healthy diet. And after a while, sure enough, it works. He puts 2 inches on his chest, takes 2 inches off his waist. He's feeling terrific and he's looking good. So he decides to top it all off with kind of a sporty new haircut. So he goes to the barber, gets his haircut. This is before the pandemic, obviously. Gets his haircut and he's on his way out the door when all of a sudden he steps off the curb, gets run over by a bus. Sad, sad story. So as he's lying there in the gutter, he looks up to the heavens and he says, Lord, how could you let this happen to me? And a booming voice from the heavens says, to tell you the truth, Thompson, I didn't recognize you. Essential and accidental characteristics. So metaphysics kind of fell into disrepute in the last couple of centuries, particularly in the English-speaking world, England, this country, Australia. And I identify them in case you don't know who the English-speaking countries are. But there was one exception to the rule, and that was Alfred North Whitehead. He was an Englishman. Actually taught here for a while, taught at Harvard, beginning of the 20th century. And Alfred North Whitehead had a metaphysics. He had read all of the 20th century science. So he knew about, he was also a mathematician. He was brilliant, brilliant guy. So he knew about relativity. He knew about quantum theory, quantum mechanics. He knew how in a quantum universe, you can't predict absolutely what's going to happen next. You can only determine probabilities. So he had all this in his mind. And so he thought, well, we have to change the way we think about metaphysics, first principles. We can't think about the universe as static anymore. We have to think of it more as a process. And not only is it a process, it's an unpredictable process. We can say probably what will happen in the universe next, but we can't say for certain. So he said, you know, that's going to change the way we think about God as well. And he said, because even, in the old days, we thought of God as being omniscient. And by that, we meant that he had the whole Encyclopedia Britannica in his head. But that's not going to cut it anymore. He said, this is a process universe, unpredictable. And so even God doesn't know for sure what's going to happen next. So omniscience obviously can't be what it used to be. So he said, you know, even God essentially is learning as he goes along. So here's the story. So Alvin owns a little clothing store in Peterborough, actually, before the pandemic. And sales are going well. He's making a nice living. And he's pretty happy with his business. And then one day he's in the store and he hears a booming voice say, "Alvin, I want you to put your store up for sale." And Alvin says, "Well, why would I do that? I'm doing well." The booming voice says, "Alvin, I want you to sell your store for $3 million. And Alvin says, "$3 million? You know, it's a good business, but it's not worth $3 million. And the booming voice says, "Just do what you're told, Alvin." So Alvin says, "Okay." So he hangs a sign on the door, "Store for sale." 5 minutes later, the guy walks in and he says, "I'd like to offer you $3 million for the store." And Alvin says, "Okay." He says, "In fact," he says, "in this suitcase," he says, "I have $3 million in cash." So he opens the suitcase, shows him the cash. Alvin says, "Good." Hands him the key, walks out the door. He can't believe his good fortune. He's feeling terrific. He's walking down the street with his suitcase, and all of a sudden the booming voice says, "Well, Alvin, don't go home. I want you to take your suitcase and go to Las Vegas and get on an airplane. I mean, go to the airport and get on an airplane to Las Vegas." And Alvin says, "Okay, you say so." So he goes to the airport, gets on a plane, gets off, checks into his hotel. In Las Vegas, to get to the registration desk, you have to walk through the casino for obvious reasons. And so Alvin's walking through the casino and he hears the booming voice say, "Alvin, I want you to go to the blackjack table and put down your $3 million on a single hand of blackjack." And Alvin goes, no, please don't make me do that. And the voice says, "Alvin, just do it." So Alvin goes to the blackjack table, he puts the money down on a single hand. The dealer deals. Alvin has 18. The dealer has a 6 showing. Alvin goes, "Okay, I'll stand pat." And the booming voice says, "No, you won't. Alvin, I want you to take a hit." Alvin goes, "Oh my God, take a hit." So Alvin says, "Okay, I'll take a hit. It's an ace." Alvin goes, "Great, 19. Okay, now I will stand pat." The booming voice says, no, Alvin, I want you to take another hit." So Alvin says, "Do I have to? Okay, give me another hit." So the dealer deals him another ace. Now he's got 20. So he goes, "Oh, unbelievable." He said, I'll stand pat. And the booming voice says, no, you're not done yet, Alvin. I want you to take yet another hit." "Oh, jeez. Okay, give me another hit." So the dealer deals him again. It's a third ace, blackjack. And the booming voice says, "Unfucking believable." Whitehead's God in a probabilistic universe. How are we doing on time? Okay. So metaphysics, at least in the West, and particularly in the English-speaking world, was virtually displaced by another theory of knowledge, empiricism, the theory of knowledge that underlies science. And so... the empiricists, of course, said that you can't sit back in your chair and smoke a pipe and think about first principles. If you want to learn something about the world, you actually have to go out and look at the world. You have to make observations. And, you know, on the basis of that, that's what leads to knowledge. And some people interpreted that to mean that that's all you have to do is observe the world. But the empiricist said, no, no, it's a little more complicated than that. You know, it's not just you look at the world and you go, oh, red, blue. You know, you put it all together and you say, oh, that's a car or whatever. So consequently, they said, what you really need to do is take your sensory data and put it together with all of your prior knowledge. Make it fit together. Put it in a context. And so here's a story that illustrates what happens if you only go on the basis of your observations, your raw observations, and don't put them into to a proper context. So this is a joke that involves Sardars. Sardar actually is another word for a male Sikh, the Sikh religion in India. Religious sect in India. And when Danny and I first thought about this, we thought this might be a little politically incorrect. You know, it's kind of the Indian version, that because the Sardar ends up being the butt of the joke, and the butt of the joke is that he's not really very bright. And consequently, you know, we thought, oh, gee, you know, this is like Polish jokes in this country, which you don't hear too much anymore, or blonde jokes, which you really don't hear too much anymore. So this is, you know, this is too hot to handle. Until Danny is riding in a cab in New York City, and the cab driver, as many cab drivers are, was a Sardar. He was wearing the turban. Danny said, "Can I ask you a question?" The driver said, "Yeah." Danny says, "Well, you know, you're probably familiar with Sardar jokes." And the guy said, yeah, I sure am. And Danny said, well, let me ask you this. He said, I know they're all over the web. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Sardar jokes on the web. And he said, you know, are they offensive? And the guy said, oh, no. I said, you know, they're fine. He said, they're very funny. We tell them to each other. We put them on the web. So I said, oh, okay. In that case, we'll feel free to tell them. So here's a joke that involves Sardars and what happens when you only go on the basis of your raw sense data. So the chief of detectives in Mumbai is looking to hire a new detective. So he puts an ad in the newspaper and he gets three applicants, and all three of them are Sardars. So he says, well, I'm going to give each of you a little test, and on the basis of the test, I'll determine who gets the job. So he said, I'm going to take each of you aside. So he takes the first guy aside, and he shows him a picture for 5 seconds. He said, okay, that was the picture of a suspect. He said, tell me what you conclude about the suspect. And Sardar says, well, you know, this guy will be easy to catch. He said, you know, he only has one ear. The chief of detectives says, no. The picture is a profile. That's why you think he only has one ear. He said, you know, thank you very much. We'll call you if we need you. So he calls the second Sardar in, shows him the picture for 5 seconds, and says, you know, what can you conclude about the suspect? And the Sardar says, well, I could pick this guy out of a lineup. So he only has one eye. Chief of Detectives says, it's a profile. Okay, would you send the third gentleman in? So the third guy comes in. The chief of detectives shows him the picture and he says, well, what can you conclude about this? And the Sardar says, well, the man obviously wears contact lenses. So the chief says, well, that's a very interesting answer. He said, I'm not sure myself whether he wears contact lenses. He said, let me go check his file. So he goes, checks his file, and he comes back in. He says, yes. He says, you're absolutely right. He said, the man does wear contact lenses. He said, could I ask you this? He said, how did you reach that conclusion? And so I said, oh, it was simple. He said, you know, he only has one ear and one eye. He can't wear regular glasses. So How are we doing here on time? Okay, I should be winding down here. So one last story. So this is from the philosophical realm of ethics, ethical philosophy. When Danny and I were in college, there was a popular ethical theory at the time called emotivism. And emotivism said, X is good, doesn't tell you anything about X. It's not like saying X is red, which does tell you something about X, but X is good tells you nothing about X. It only tells you something about me. And what it tells you is, I approve of X, or I think X is okay. So that's emotivism. So a man writes a letter to the IRS, and he says, I haven't been able to sleep at night. My conscience is bothering me. He said, I cheated on last year's tax returns, and so I'm enclosing a check for $500. And if I still can't sleep, I'll send you the rest. Emotivism. So with that, let's stop and see if there are any questions, and I'd be happy to answer them. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for your fascinating and entertaining talk. They said it couldn't be done, illustrating philosophical ideas with jokes, and you've done that. Thank you. We have time for some questions from the audience, and as our speaker responds to those sent, you may continue to submit questions on Facebook and YouTube comments or by sending an email to monlyceum@gmail.com. So let me start by asking you, has your study of philosophy influenced how you've lived your life or how you deal with what's happening in the world?
I think indirectly, yeah. The take that a lot of people have on philosophy is that, you know, it's kind of pie in the sky. It doesn't prepare you for anything else. But I think in a way it does kind of sharpen your thinking, gives you, more of a nose for baloney. I think in that way, it sort of influenced Danny's and my lives considerably. Neither one of us has had a career in philosophy, unless you consider Plato and a platypus a career. I think we would both agree that it sort of does change the way you look at the world, and maybe your level of skepticism, maybe your level of searching for the good in things. I don't know, but in many ways, I think it kind of sharpens your sense of being in the world.
Thank you. A member of our audience asked a question that might kind of harken back to your last story. They said, in Plato and the Platypus walk into a bar, many, not all, of the jokes seem to be at the expense of women. So you were talking about politically correct. Were you to have written the book this year instead of in 2007, would you have used different jokes?
Gee, I'd have to go back and look at all the jokes. There are, of the ones I told this morning, I can't think of any that were at the expense of women. Were they? I don't know. I need some help with this, I guess. If somebody could specifically ask me about specific jokes, yeah, I'd be glad to respond. But right off the top of my head, I'm drawing a blank.
Okay,
but yes, if that turns out to be true, yes, of course, we would probably write it differently today.
And another viewer asked, philosophy and humor are compatible, but what about religion and humor?
Say that again.
Philosophy and humor are compatible. What about religion and humor?
Religion and humor. You know, we tried to write, I've told one joke, religious joke, I guess, this morning. There are two or three others in the book. But we couldn't really make it work as enough of a theme to produce a book. There are a lot of jokes out there about religion, of course. Some of them are offensive, and we wouldn't tell those. But some of them aren't, and, they're kind of harmless. But there just weren't enough of them to make a book, I guess.
Do you think it would be a vehicle for teaching religion?
Useful in teaching religion? Yeah, maybe, I guess. Yeah, Can I tell a quick joke? This is an old joke. Probably many people in the audience have heard it before. You know, one of the discussions in philosophy and religion is the contrast between faith and reason. And so here's the story. A guy is out walking in the woods, and all of a sudden he steps into an abandoned well, and he's falling down this well, and flailing about trying to save himself. He reaches out and he grabs a hold of a root, a spindly root that's sticking out of the wall of the well. And he's hanging on for dear life, and he yells up, "Is there anybody up there?" There's no answer. He yells, "Is there anybody up there?" Still no answer. So a third time he yells at the top of his voice, "Is there anybody else up there?" And again, a booming voice says, "Yes, I am the Lord your God. I am here to save you. Let go of the root." And the guy says, "Is there anybody else up there?"
Another question. This is an interesting one. Why was Aristotle's post hoc ergo propter hoc in Latin when Aristotle was Greek?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I guess at some point along the line, somebody other than Aristotle decided to call it by a Latin name. You got me.
I've been wondering, back when you were going into college, what drew you to the study of philosophy? Most people go into fields where there's some profession at the end. I too majored in philosophy, and I wonder why. So what drew you to that?
Yeah, well, I was terribly impractical at that age. My wife would tell you I still am. But actually, what immediately attracted me was religion, actually. I went off to college with the view toward becoming a minister. I was going to go on to divinity school, which, as you mentioned, I actually did for a couple of years before deciding that that wasn't my calling. But that was my intention. So I took this course, big survey course of philosophy, and one of the books we read was David Hume, 18th century empiricist, and the name of the book was Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. And in that book, he basically destroys, all the philosophical arguments for the existence of God. And I was like stunned. I didn't know what to think. And so I was flailing about, but I was so attracted to it, the reasonableness of it and the argumentation. It just, I don't know, something about it grabbed me. And so I decided to major in philosophy. But in the meantime, I sat up all night one night and I read Paul Tillich's, a book by Paul Tillich, in which, he says, faith isn't like, empiricism. it's something totally different. It has to do with ultimate concern, what you care about, what you're invested in, what you personally feel is, your milieu, as it were. So then that got me sort of back on track, and I continued on to divinity school. And when I dropped out, it wasn't for reasons of lack of faith. It was because I didn't see a good fit with the parish ministry. That's what kind of drew me in.
Thank you. You've mentioned many areas of philosophy, ethics and logic and metaphysics and epistemology. Which area were you most interested in, or has that changed over the years?
I don't know. I guess the people that I've read most over the years are the people who comment on religion, because I still have a big interest in religion, but also some of the existentialists, Camus and Sartre, Heidegger. Heidegger is totally dense. I don't really understand most of what he says. Kierkegaard in particular. Kierkegaard was a 19th century religious thinker, actually, who was sort of the father of existentialism. And he's very subtle, and you have to read it three times to really figure out what he's talking about. But I would say that that's been sort of my sustaining interest over the years.
Thank you. And one last thing, can you talk a little bit about the process of you and Daniel Klein writing together?
As I mentioned, except for a very short period, have never lived in the same place. So we basically wrote by email. One of us would, Danny has a very good, first of all, a very good knowledge of jokes. But second of all, he's got a very good nose for philosophy. And because I went to divinity school, I'm a little more conversant, not much, but a little more conversant with philosophy. So he would smell out a joke and say, I think there's something here. Help me, spin out what it is. And so he would send me a joke. And sometimes I said, I don't know. I don't see any philosophical point in it at all. But, occasionally I'd say, oh, yeah, it's the law of non-contradiction or, whatever. So that was basically how we operated. Occasionally we would start from the philosophy and then find a joke. But that was hard to do because the jokes weren't really, about philosophy. They were about, cab drivers or, whatever. They were only coincidentally about philosophy. So in the ordinary situation, we would start with a joke and then we would look for the philosophy. So we did it basically by email. And both of us contributed the philosophical part, and both of us contributed jokes. He contributed a lot more jokes than I did. And then we looked through books and the web and found a lot of jokes that neither one of us knew before. So that's how we did it, basically by email.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Tom, for sharing your time and expertise with us. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein's books are available through the Toadstool Bookstore in Peterborough. Our program next Sunday will feature author Gish Jen, who will be presenting Writing the Resistors. We hope you've enjoyed today's live broadcast of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you for your support of our unique 2020 season, and we hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you.